Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon. And this is New Tricks for Old Dogs. Our podcast features our comments about what's going on in the world and a conversation with a senior who has found a way to bring new energy and meaning into their life.
So grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us. In today's episode, the old dogs share their thoughts on UFOs.
Question whether hot dog eating is a spectator sport.
Discuss how much value a wall has.
Present some boomer life hacks.
And offer up a new trivia feature called Guess What Year It Is.
Our old dogs conversation features part two of our interview with Jackie Dryden. This former advertising art director has made a new career out of offering advice to parents through the voices of children. Stay with us. You know, Paul, I have been thinking about something that I've been reading about in the paper lately.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
Well, it's about UFOs. You know, we've been talking about it for years, but it seems to be a hot topic now. That what if the government has been withholding information from us, and how much can they be forced to reveal to us?
Oh, yes. Another paranoid theory. Well, you know what I think of when I think about UFOs was my childhood. In the 50s, that was a big topic. It was always kind of in hushed tones. Well, you know, they're here.
Yeah.
And there was also part of that was the government piece of it where, oh, yeah, they have in the Area 52, they've got this whole spaceship. And a dead alien that they're keeping in a refrigerator. I don't know. What's your position?
You don't know. Well, of course you don't know because they're not telling us.
I'm sorry. Is my antenna showing?
I think that there is probably some credence to it, especially in light of all of the science fiction shows we've watched, that there are wormholes in space that, spacecraft can go through, because otherwise there's no way that you could travel at the speed of light and get anywhere else in the universe.
Well, I tell you the thing, the movement now is more scientific than it was sensational as it was in the 50s. I mean, there were comic books and all sorts of stuff. And what they are doing is they're gathering together reports from trained military pilots, trained airline pilots that have encountered on a regular basis what used to be called unidentified flying objects. I don't know what the current phrase is that they use. So if there is this advanced civilization that is watching us, why the heck don't they join in and fix stuff, huh?
Yeah, really.
With their technology, I mean, they... Global warming could be handled, and certainly warfare could be handled. And
I can only make one conclusion here, Paul, and that is that they know that we're doomed, and they're waiting around to pick up the scraps and eat us.
Oh, there you go. Or perhaps they have an insurance policy on us. Or what if it's a game? What if the aliens are playing a game, fantasy football?
Right.
And they're betting on the different countries.
Yes, and we lose.
Yeah, we lose, but they win.
The New York Times covers local sports, including the Yankees, the Nets, and Nathan's hot dog eating contest, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And that means covering Joey Jaws Chestnut, the perennial winner of the hot dog gorge.
If we're going to call competitive eating a sport, we need to talk about the ideal build for an eater.
Sure.
The ideal body type includes a short neck, so food travels faster to the stomach, a wide rib cage that allows for maximum stomach expansion, a long torso with more vertical space for food, and a wide build with more horizontal space for food.
Well, Chestnut stands 6 foot tall, weighs 230 pounds. His build is certainly stocky, but not obese. As one pundit offered, he's kind of a wide guy. He's built to fit stuff.
Now, Chestnut holds the current record of 76 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
But he also has more than 50 other eating records, ranging from 12.5 pounds of asparagus in 10 minutes to 81 waffles in 8 minutes.
Well, Paul, what do you think about that? Are we talking?
I'm feeling full just talking about it. I don't know, man. Is it a sport or a geek show, Jim?
Well, I think it's both, really. I mean, you know, it's competitive. I guess anything that's competitive will make it a sport.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if there's a record for biting the heads off chickens.
I suppose there is, but I don't want to participate. But I will tell you one thing. I would like to find a contest that matches my body type, okay? I'm not sure I know what that is, but, you know, I've got a body type. Certainly there's something I can do with it.
Yeah, sitting in a rocking chair and rocking for 10 minutes.
Ha ha.
We boomers have witnessed a lot of events over our lifetimes, but can you remember what happened when? We're going to give you a series of events, and you guess what year was it?
The U.S. launches its first satellite, Explorer 1.
The microchip was invented.
Arnold Palmer won his first Masters golf tournament.
Stereo recordings became available.
The Barbie doll was introduced.
Hula hoops become a national craze.
Hit songs included The Purple People Eater and At the Hop.
Some popular TV shows were Wagon Train, The Rifleman, and The Donna Reed Show.
And a new house cost $12,750.
So what year was it? If you guessed 1961, you were wrong. The year was 1958. And you, there. As we prepare for our show, we spend a lot of time on the internet. We recently landed on a website called Techie Twist.
And they had an article that featured weird life hacks that were credited to boomers. Now, if you're not familiar with the term, a life hack is a trick to make life easier.
Since one of our responsibilities is to report on the boomer lifestyle, here are some suggestions for tricks to make life easier. We neither advocate or judge the legality of these suggestions.
Okay, hack one. If you need new tires for your car, rent a car and switch tires with your car. A one-day rental is definitely cheaper than buying four new tires.
You know, this one seems a little borderline illegal, Jim, but hey, if you're really desperate for four tires, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to try it. I guess if I do it at night, then it's okay.
Yeah, well, that would even make it more illegal.
Okay, what's the next
hack? Number two, and this is one that's easy. When booking a hotel room, add the prefix doctor. When assigning rooms, the hotel will always give preferential treatment to somebody identified as a doctor.
Well,
Dr. Conlon, what do you think about that one?
Dr. Paul, I think that this is a no-brainer, frankly. Hack three.
Another one?
When you're meeting someone for lunch, tell them you are twice as far away than you actually are. Then offer to meet them halfway. Ho ho. That would be a block from where you actually are.
Oh, I like that one.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to eat a sandwich on a bus stop. Make sure you're near a restaurant.
Besides, I know the restaurants right around me much better than I know them anywhere else.
Okay, here's a hack that I've actually thought about, although never did it. Keep a beverage cup from McDonald's in your car. Whenever you want a soda, stop at any McDonald's and fill it up. No one will question you.
Well, I'd question you.
Unless, of course, the cup is falling apart.
Yeah, how long can you keep a cup from McDonald's?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hmm.
And we got one more.
Okay, hack five. Keep an orange vest and an orange flag in your car when you attend a sporting event. After the game, when the parking lot is bumper to bumper, have someone in your car put on the vest and use the flag to get your car in line for an earlier exit.
All right.
Wow, what
I
a
like
great
that
idea.
And that might come in handy in several ways, not just sporting events.
Yeah.
On the freeway, for example.
Your very own lane.
In line at a McDonald's when the line is too long.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, what you also should do is put one of those cones in your trunk so that you can park anywhere you like, and you put a cone behind the car.
Ah, you probably need two cones to make that one.
Two
work.
Cones, okay.
Folks, these are hacks that you may not have the nerve to try, but I might give a whack at them. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think you just tell them, well, I'm old, So it's
there
okay.
There you go. I don't know better.
That's it. You know, we ran across this item in the Washington Post. A property in posh Georgetown in a prime location was listed for $50,000. The owner, a guy named Alan Berger, seemed to be offering the property way below market value.
The problem was the property was just a wall.
What?
Nothing else. On one side of the wall was a parking lot owned by another party.
Okay.
On the other side, the wall was actually attached to a home. The homeowner owns the interior 12 inches of the brick wall, but not the exterior 12 inches. That belongs to Berger.
At one point in the past, the wall was probably part of a building, but now it is just a wall. Deed records show that a buyer purchased the wall in the 1960s for $2.14. He in turn sold it to Berger's father, and Berger later inherited it.
You know, you can't even walk up to the wall because that land is part of the parking lot. You have to admire it from the street. Now, since it's unlikely that somebody is going to buy it, how can Alan Berger commercialize his wall? Well, we are going to give him some suggestions.
Okay, well, he could paint something on it, I suppose, and charge admission for looking at it or photographing it.
And I was thinking umbrella rentals. He could do little like hooks in the walls and rent umbrellas from his wall.
Okay, or perhaps have a painted advertising on them.
Great idea. Yeah. Maybe for one of the posh restaurants in that posh neighborhood.
Or maybe our podcast.
But no matter what, it's not worth $50,000.
No, I guess not.
And I think it further said it's kind of slowly falling apart. So
yeah.
If you're going to buy it, you better get that offer in soon.
You know, I'm reminded of Robert Frost, Paul, who said...
Oh, the famous wall poet.
Something there is about a wall that wants it down. In part one of our conversation with Jackie Dryden, we covered her career in the advertising business. Near the end of part one, she talked about starting a parallel career giving talks on parenting. Then she had a serious health issue, which had a profound effect on her approach to parenting advice. We'll pick up our conversation as she explains what happened.
Somewhere in the 90s, I started doing parenting talks with a child therapist and another mom. We did a thing called Two Moms and a Shrink. We had a working mom, a stay-at-home mom, and a child therapist. And we talked all over the country, and people kept telling me I had good insights, I should write a book. And I was like, I'm just me. You know, I'm just Jackie. I don't have any PhD, MD, you know, therapist, psychologist behind my name. I'm just a working mom, stepmom, now grandmother. But I realized that some of the problems that I was dealing with in advertising and talking to people and their motivations were seated in the stories that they started believing in childhood. And if you want me to, I'll tell you a quick story on how it happened for me.
Yes, please.
So I'd been doing this speaking in the 90s, and people kept telling me, write a book. And I was like, I tried to write, when you do this, and he and she and your son and your daughter and you and he and she and they, and it felt very inauthentic. And I just couldn't get the words out. And in 2004, I had a brain aneurysm. I was in the neuro ICU after surgery, and I was kind of making deals with God. You know, I was kind of in that stage where I was like, if this is it, I've had a great time. Thanks for the ride. Love on my family. Felt very at peace with that. But if I stay, let me know why I'm still here. I want something grander to attach to. I'm lying there, you know, you've got all the beeps and the pumps on everything and the tubes everywhere. You're just kind of this inert being there trying to heal. And it was as if someone had put chairs all around that hospital bed and put children in them. And they started talking to me. And I heard them say, tell our stories. Remind our parents what it's like to be a child. Tell them how we feel. And as soon as my brain started healing, I sat down and I wrote, Dear Mom and Dad, this is what I'd like to tell you. And I listened to the children's voices, and I basically transcribed all the things I could think of that the children were telling me that they wish their parents knew. And that was kind of the beginning of this new chapter.
Hmm. Fascinating. Wow. So this, whatever it was, this vision that you had in a hospital bed became the subject matter for your first book. Is that correct?
It did. I wrote down 43 little one-page things that the kids said, from "you be the boss," "I don't know what I'm doing," to "stop yelling and whisper," to "I'm not your do-over." I mean, all of these things came through, and I heard them from first-person child's voice.
Wow.
And it became super simple. It just flew down on the page because it was coming from that, not from a place of teaching or telling anybody how to do anything.
Tell us, what do you hope to accomplish with that part of your work?
This has been the hardest part of this, Paul, is actually saying, what do you do with this now that you feel this overwhelming connection with these children? And so, yes, I am going to be starting my own podcast. I mean, I work as justjackie.com because that's very simple. It's me. But I looked at workshops, and I'm doing some coaching and some podcasts and some speaking. And ultimately, what I really want from this work is I want parents to see and hear their children differently. And when I can point out moments, instances, things that are happening that they can look at a different way of dealing with it, correcting it, interacting, magic happens. And I've seen it, and I've gotten the letters, and the most profound letter came from a child, which I was not talking to children, I'm talking to parents. But I had a child write me a letter to say, "My mom and I came to hear you talk, and now when she takes me to school, we have very different conversations, and we are much closer than we've ever been. And I wanted to thank you for what you said." And I just fell on the floor.
Are you ever in a place where you look back on rearing your own children and thinking, yeah, I should have done this, or I might have done that, or I wish I hadn't, you know, done what you did? And I'll tell you quite honestly, I go through that all the time, right? So I wonder, a person with your perspective, how do you deal with that?
It's a great question, because I think as parents, we all deal with that. And the one thing I know is if you're a parent, you're going to mess up. It's going to be the things you didn't think it would be. You know, sometimes we get all the big things right. And we made some comment one day about not liking that pair of shorts, you know, in passing, or something about a friend that we weren't crazy about. And we just said, well, why are you friends with that kid? And when your children become adults, they'll parrot this back to you and go, I was so crushed when you told me this. And you're like, I don't even remember saying that. So I think we mostly get the big things right. A lot of times it's the things that we are not noticing. And the way that I have discovered to notice those in real time is through this observation and connection and asking different kinds of questions. Because here's one of my favorite things. When you pick up a child from school and you say, how was your day? What do they say?
Okay.
Yeah, fine, okay. What did you do today?
Stuff.
Yeah, nothing, stuff. Then that's the end of the conversation. You drive on home.
This is what I have to deal with, Jim, as an 8-year-old.
Yeah, I know.
What did you do, Jim? What? Stuff.
He doesn't understand me. Okay, so how do you conclude then with that conversation?
Well, it depends on the child, because what I say is you can't learn to parent in a book or from anyone else. You can only learn from that child, because each one is different. We can't make them all be the same, so you have to kind of adjust. But you can start saying things like, was there anything that happened today in school that made you laugh out loud? Is there something that somebody said that you don't believe is true and they thought was true? What made you today go, that's interesting? And the first few times that you do that, you won't get much response, because it's kind of weird coming out of left field. You've never done this before. You know Bethany Andel at Savage, and I was talking to Bethany about her 8-year-old son, and she says, we never say anything in the car. So I gave her about 10 questions she could start asking it. She said day one, he was like, what is this? You know, this is silly. Day two, he was like, why are you asking me this? Day three, he was answered one of the questions. By day four, he came to the car anticipating the questions. He had observed things differently at school. He had connected differently because he knew he was going to have this dialogue. And she said, he got in the car and she said, you know, something like, what was something you learned today that you thought was the wildest thing you've ever heard? And he says, Mom, I have to tell you, I'm into World War II. I learned this and I learned this. And she said, I never knew this about him. I took him to a World War II museum. We bonded over this. We had different conversations. So it is, it's just a way of pulling things from your child, feeding them back, and creating a different dialogue.
These days, we see a lot of situations where grandparents are raising children, or grandparents are spending a lot of time with their grandchildren. Are there some special challenges there?
There are. One of the things I say is grandparents and grandchildren get along so well because we have a common enemy. They're in the middle, you know, we have to be very respectful because we are not setting the rules, but I believe we can have a huge influence on our grandchildren. And we can spend the time to listen and participate and watch behaviors that the parents don't have the time for. Parents are crushed. They're pushing. They're running. They're out of time. And as grandparents, we can sit down with those children and have different kinds of dialogue. I'm also harder on my grandchildren than my daughter is. And she will say to me, you're a little rough on them. And I say, yeah, they're not quite stepping up to doing things, you know, leaving the dish here and not picking that up and just dropping things. And I'm in my house, you're going to acknowledge that there's other people here. So there are times when my rules are slightly different here, and that's okay as long as they're not hurting the way that the parents are bringing up the children. And I ask them and I tell them the things that I'm doing. And the greatest lesson that I have learned as a grandparent is don't offer advice unless it's asked for. That one will get you every time. You just throw it out there because you're feeling something, it usually doesn't end up well. Yeah. Just say, I have a thought if you are open to hearing it.
Well, it sounds like a whole new workshop that you could develop, grandparenting skills.
I hadn't even thought about this. And I love it. You're pushing me down a new road. Thank you.
Let's hope it's not a rabbit hole.
I've been through those. I'm not scared.
Your life now is a life of service. And there's something deeply gratifying about that. For folks our age who have left behind their first career and are looking for something to invest in, what do you recommend?
I realize when people start talking to me about being retired and I say I'm busier now than I've ever been, well, why? You could just go relax. And I say my body retired, but my brain and my heart did not. I'm still curious. I'm still reading, researching, absorbing. And I think as a retired person, you have the opportunity to lean into something that lights you up, whatever that is, and grab onto it and don't just do it rotely. Grow with it, learn with it, probe, find other people that are interested in that. I realized the other day that I want to go take an astrophysics course at Vanderbilt in the continuing education. I'm not going to be an astrophysicist, but I want my brain to continue to grow and question and learn. I think if you approach life that way after retirement, there's so many things that can light you up and delight you. And if you really grab a hold of it, it spills out to other people.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.